on seniors and people with disabilities will come to order. Welcome. Okay, this is the first hearing of the first day of our supplemental special session, second day. Well, it's the first day that we're having committee hearings, so we have the honor to be the first committee to have a hearing. And today, first of all, we're going to adopt the rules.
Open an organizational meeting, Mr. Chair.
Pardon me?
If you will open an organizational meeting.
Yeah, okay. We're going to open the organizational meeting.
Mr. Chair, I move adoption of rules.
Senator Cruz moves adoption of the rules. Discussion of the rules. Seeing no discussion. Any objection? Seeing no objection. So ordered. We're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1061. There is another item on the agenda today that we will not be dealing with today. We'll deal with it on Thursday. So, and that's SCR 24 commemorates Hood to Coast Relay. We will have a special event on Thursday.
Maybe the most important bill of the entire session.
Maybe the important, most important bill during the entire session. Everyone, please wear your running shoes on Thursday if you're going to be here. And we'll maybe distribute water bottles, too. The president's office, I think, will have some things. So. Okay. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1061. And James Caves, would you come up, please, and lead us through the discussion?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, James Taves from the Department of Human Services. I know we've talked about this bill at length in the interim committee, so I'll be very brief again. The department supports the bill. It really has three parts. One speaks to an interim rate increase for assisted living, foster care, and residential care facilities for seniors and people with physical disabilities, where we've experienced the most loss of Medicaid capacity in the last year and a half, with a corresponding increase in nursing home usage, which is pretty alarming in terms of Oregon's long-term care system. So that's really dealt with in Section 1. Section 2 really codifies the long-range planning activity that's going on as a result of a task force the governor called together several years ago. Then we received some pretty explicit instructions by budget note from the Ways and Means Committee about looking both at the aging demographic, how to prepare for that, changes in Medicaid or Medicaid waivers, and particularly to attend to our whole rate structure to develop much more of a complexity of need or acuity-based Medicaid rate system across our programs. And we have a report that will be due on July 1st of this year to the E-Board or whatever appropriate interim committee per that budget note. And then much of that is codified in this bill as well. And then Section 3 really calls for a series of other analyses that the department will do about other programs. Some of them are programs that were lost in previous biennia during the recessionary years, and requests that we come back and really reproject what it would cost to fully fund those programs and restore some of the parts of the system that were lost several years ago. With that said, the remaining concern for us is still the language in Section 1, which we've talked about before, and the language in Section 1 that talks about the interim rate increase. And let me preface this again. From our perspective, technically Section 1 is not needed to make the adjustments in the budget, which the department has proposed, the $9.7 million in our rebalance plan, and there are several versions now in the co-chair's recommended budget around that. But nonetheless, that is part of our rebalance plan. We typically do rate adjustments all the time in both the regular budget cycle and during emergency board sessions, depending on the circumstance. So we don't need statutory language. Technically, it was brought forward, again, because of everyone's interest that both a short-term crisis and the longer-term planning issues sort of come together in one place. But having said that, if it's the choice to leave Section 1 in, the current language does not work. It basically says that we would almost have to guarantee, it says the rates have to be at level sufficient to maintain the capacity of all residential care facilities and adult foster homes providing Medicaid services, and we simply can't make that kind of guarantee, and I think that would create a legal liability for the department. So included in my testimony is the original amendment that we proposed some months ago that we would still encourage you to adopt if the section remains in. We know that SEIU and others want to make sure that there is discretionary language, that we may also increase rates if the money is available in a couple other critical areas that are not included in the senior and physical disability program, and we have no objection to that. And that's fine. But again, the language in Section 1 as it stands is problematic.
What is sufficient?
Mr. Chairman, I guess that would be our point. If the language says the rates must be sufficient to guarantee capacity, I think any provider could say, well, unless you increase it to this level, I'm not going to maintain my Medicaid capacity, and we'd have a real disconnect at that point.
Okay.
And to further clarify, Mr. Chairman, our point is this is an interim adjustment to deal with an immediate crisis.
Yeah.
It still begs the question of what our entire rate structure is going to be that both competes at some level with the private marketplace and adjusts rates based on changing client needs and acuity, and our rate system just does not do that very discreetly. So we're still working towards a longer-term solution, a full-blown plan that we'll present in July and probably as part of the budget cycle in the next legislative session. So no one, from our perspective, is arguing that these rates or even on an interim basis are sufficient or adequate. I mean, we wouldn't use any of those words. We're doing an interim rate adjustment, which we believe, based on our discussions with the industry, will maintain our Medicaid capacity and hopefully even bring back some of the providers that have given up their Medicaid capacity. That's our goal here.
Okay. Questions, comments?
Mr. Chair. And obviously, before Friday, we will have a better picture, I think, of what our budget world is going to look like. So my concern, as I expressed during the last committee meeting, and I'll express again, is, you know, if indeed we have assurances, and if we can get it somehow signed in blood that the rebalance is going to take care of this rate issue, I'm not sure that part of the bill is necessary. I wish we had two bills here so we could have one to go to Ways and Means and the rest of it not. I've seen some good things go to Ways and Means and disappear, and I'd hate to see that happen. And clearly, Section 2, there's a budget note on it, but I think having it here makes it stronger and better, and I like that. And Section 3, I think, is some critical information we're going to need for the decision process in 09. And so I want to make sure that we can capture those two portions of the bill. I can almost guarantee at this point if Sections 2 and 3 were in a separate bill, I can't imagine anybody in either chamber voting against the bill. But with the compression we are having on the time frame, and if we end up dumping too many things down in Ways and Means because they're going to be under a lot of pressure themselves, some things may be at risk here. And it's just a concern I have.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, we could petition the president and allow it to go across the Senate floor, but as is. But I guess we still have a decision point out in time, clear till Friday on this, but as to what sort of assurances we could get out of the good folks at the other end of the building that the rates are part of the overall plan. If we had those assurances, I'd be supportive of taking Section 1 out and running the bill out without it.
What is your feeling about what if you did take Section 1 out? You said a little while ago that it isn't necessary, and that that would be one option. Another option would be to amend it. But if we did take it out, where do you think that would leave you?
Mr. Chairman, we're proposing the rate increase, and it's our rebalance, and we think we have the authority already, assuming it's approved by this body, to move ahead with that rate increase. So technically, again, Section 1 is not needed. It was included because this has been part of the focus about both the short-term crisis and the longer-term planning. So I think really it's your choice whether it remains in or not, depending on assurances on what appears in the final rebalance or the Ways and Means process. I would leave that to your discretion. If you leave it in, the current language, however, does not work.
Well, if we leave it in and even amend it, it's still to take out the sufficiency word and idea. It still has no binding power on the Ways and Means Committee necessarily, because they will make a decision. This bill will then go to Ways and Means, never to see the light of day again, perhaps. And that's part of the concern. There's nothing we can do to force Ways and Means. You know, a lot will depend on the revenue forecast. However, Ways and Means has given every indication that they do intend to fund your request using the rebalance that is accrued in your division. So that seems to be the direction we're headed. Now, Senator Cruz's point, I think, is well taken, because if it is heard in the Senate, goes to the House, and is heard, and then is referred to Ways and Means, it will not have been passed, and then the rest of the bill will kind of be, you know, in never-never land, and so to speak. So I think Senator Cruz's point is very well taken. I would confer with my colleague from the House side, but she's not here right now.
Mr. Chairman, I think Senator Cruz's point that Sections 2 and 3 are good policy direction.
Yeah.
We agree with that. We think they are good policy directions.
Okay. Well, we're not going to have a work session on this bill until Friday, so we have an opportunity to consider this. So, other questions concerning? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Jim Carlson, would you please come up and enlighten us?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Jim Carlson, representing the Oregon Healthcare Association. I would like to speak in support of Senate Bill 1061, and I would also like to thank this committee, in particular, and Representative Cowan, who stepped out of the hearing room, for all the hard work you've put into really addressing some very important issues that have a real impact on a lot of Oregonians. I think starting with some discussions that began really at the end of last session, where a number of issues were identified that did not get addressed, did not have time to be addressed during the last session. This committee, and thanks to your leadership and your hard work, has really, I think, had a very productive 4 or 5 months in the interim to identify a number of strategies, a number of policies, a number of key issues that need to be addressed here. I also would like to acknowledge and thank the work that James Taves at Senior and People with Disabilities and his staff have done on working on these issues. James and I had occasion yesterday to attend a meeting with a large cross-section of providers. Some of those were providers who had already made decisions to begin withdrawing from the Medicaid program. Some were providers who were at a point right now where they were were considering whether they were going to take that action or not. And I think to a member on the folks we talked to yesterday, they are watching very closely what happens here. I think folks are very encouraged that the legislature and that the agency has recognized some of the seriousness of some of these issues and some of these problems. And we're looking at a host of strategies and solutions that go beyond just what may happen in Ways and Means, what may happen on rates and sufficiency of rates, and trying to come up with some other strategies to incentivize folks to continue to participate in the Medicaid program, to try to incentivize them to be in it for the long haul, some things that are long-term strategies, because I think with the aging demographics of our population and what we're going to see happening, it's going to be very key that the planning and the work that we're doing now builds a very strong delivery system, builds a very strong, sound infrastructure that will not only meet the needs of Oregonians today, but will meet the needs of Oregonians in the future who require these services. Just a couple of the things that are under discussion that I think the agency is going to explore for other strategies or techniques to try to incentivize more folks to participate. One of the things is DHS has already let a RFP out and awarded an RFP for a firm to do a market study, a market analysis of what's going on in all the different geographic regions of the state in the substitute home community-based care system in terms of what are the market rates, what are the market dynamics going on out there, because the state has to purchase services out there in all these different markets, and that's been one of the issues is to maintain that access when there's very dynamic private marketplace out there. And so that is a study that the state has already commissioned, and they've got a meeting set up for later this month with their contractor and other folks to begin work on that study. And my understanding is the timeline for getting the results of that back is the 1st of June. So they're working very hard right now at the department, I think, to try to get more information, better information out there, and to try to get that information turned around and available to folks to take a look at by June. And that's information that can then be used as they're making decisions in budget preparation for the 2009-2011 biennium, which I think is important. One of the other issues that's been identified in the provider community, where a number of other states do things differently than Oregon traditionally has done things, and a number of other states, Washington in particular, state of Washington has allowed providers to essentially contract to provide services to X number of Medicaid clients or taking X number of Medicaid slots. So they would, you know, say we'll take, you know, we'll contract for, you know, for 20 Medicaid slots, or we'll contract for 15 or 25. And Oregon historically has not allowed that. You're either kind of all in the program or all out. And there are a lot of providers out there that we've had discussions with who would be very interested in entering into a Medicaid contract who historically have never contracted with Medicaid in the past. And we think that looking at changing that rule and some conversations there could very well likely lead to greater participation, greater Medicaid access by providers.
Now, let me be clear about the need to do it by rule. Why can't a why can't an assisted living facility simply say, I will only take X number? Could you explain that?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Morissette, currently under Oregon administrative rule on the provisions governing Medicaid contracting, you can't do that currently. With a rule change, that could be allowed, that could be permitted. And so there was quite a bit of discussion yesterday, I think mostly favorable, that that would be an effective tool that doesn't have a fiscal impact, it doesn't cost money in the Ways and Means process, but it could encourage folks. So, excuse me, an example would be we've got a member who operates a facility that's all private. They've never had a Medicaid contract. They go through a very difficult situation if they have a resident who's maybe been a resident of their community for 4 or 5 years, and they spend down and deplete assets. The term of art in Medicaid is spend down. You spend down, and all of a sudden you qualify for Medicaid. Currently, right now, they've got one kind of charity care slot that they keep available for someone who's a longtime resident. They've got another resident who, you know, they're projecting within just a very short period of time is going to spend down. He's indicated to us, clearly says, you know, I would love to be able to contract with the state and say, you know, we'd like to contract for 5 Medicaid residents, or we'd like to contract for X amount.
Wait just a minute. There has been a situation in the state of Oregon, and Representative Cowan in her district, and that's one of the reasons she's so concerned about this, where a facility actually asked their Medicaid people to leave. Now, are you saying that if, under the current contracts, if people take private pay and they do spend down and they only have one slot for charity, that the second person would be asked to leave?
Mr. Chair, Senator Moore said, under the current rules and regs, somebody can essentially choose, if they're all private, someone can essentially choose whether they take a Medicaid contract, whether they contract with the state or not. If they do not contract with the state and somebody's assets are depleted, okay, and they become Medicaid eligible, and if that provider does not have a Medicaid contract, they are not eligible to provide Medicaid services, nor bound by that. This is required to be disclosed up front prior to admission, and some of the consumer disclosure rules and regulations and requirements up front. And that's a responsibility that's not only a legal obligation, but it's a responsibility I think service providers take very seriously on the front end on that consumer disclosure that we do not have a Medicaid contract, or we do. The particular case, and as Representative Cowan knows well, that occurred down in her district was you had a provider who had a Medicaid contract, and essentially this is fortunately the only situation we've ever had like this in my tenure in Oregon where someone did an immediate withdrawal from Medicaid. They canceled their Medicaid contract. They gave notice that on such and such a date, under the notice provisions under the contract, we will no longer be providing Medicaid services. And under that situation, it did require essentially relocations and transfers of some folks. It was very disruptive to those individuals. It was very disruptive to their families, to the aging services network, the whole community. And I believe a number of those individuals were not able to find access to services in their own county and were forced to essentially relocate to another service area to get the services they need.
Okay, so under the scenario that you're suggesting, then a change of rule would allow assisted living, adult foster home, residential care facilities to sign a contract with the state to take a limited number. Now, would that limited number include? Wow. Okay. Let me back up just a bit. Without that contract, they may take 4 or 5 people who will spend down, and then they will end up with several Medicaid contracts anyway. Now, their obligation, though, is they don't have an obligation to do Medicaid under that scenario, so they could ask those people.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator, that providers can make a decision. I mean, they're able to make a decision. Will they not contract? I think you've got a dynamic in place. When you have folks who've been living in a particular assisted living, foster care, residential care, they become a part of that community, and there's relationships there. And
Wait just a minute. They don't know ahead of time. If they're private pay and they take private pay people, they don't know for sure that these people will not spend down, and they may end up with what's the existing? There is no existing protection for people who spend down then in private facilities without a contract. Is that right?
No, Mr. Chair, Senator Moore said at the time of admission, if you're moving into a facility that does not have a Medicaid contract and they're disclosing to you, we do not have a Medicaid contract, they have that discussion, which means that if you at some point in time move on to Medicaid and we don't have a Medicaid contract, you are going to have to move.
Okay.
And one of the problems we have that we've identified as you're watching the nursing facility caseloads in Medicaid, mm-hmm. Oftentimes if you have someone and they've been in, let's say, an assisted living residential care community, and they've been there for 2.5, 3, 4, 5 years, during that period of time, generally speaking, their care needs increase, some of their impairment levels, other things as the aging process progresses or acute care episodes occur. And so at that point in time, oftentimes those folks will end up transferring to a higher level of care on Medicaid at a higher cost to the state, whereby if a Medicaid contract was in place in that facility and that person could continue to be cared for in that setting, it's not only less disruptive to that individual, to the service provider and everyone else, but it's more cost effective for the state to be delivering the services there. Because at that point, when a transfer is going to have to occur, oftentimes if they're very high impairment, that's the only other setting they can go where their needs can be met.
Okay. How many facilities who do not have Medicaid contracts would you anticipate signing a contract for with a cap?
Yeah. Ms. Chair, Senator Moore said, I don't want to give you a specific
number.
I don't know, but I believe based upon conversations I've had with a number of providers, and many of these providers do deliver services in Washington State as well as in Oregon, where the rules are different. We heard in our meeting yesterday from one of the providers who's one of the largest providers in the state of Washington that they've only ever had in the last 5 years, I think, two folks that they ever transferred out of any of their communities, due to a spend down issue ever. And it's because they essentially do those limited Medicaid contracts up there. And so that was, you know, that was out of a very large number of individuals they've cared for up in that state. And so just using that and using other information to provide to me, I believe there'd be a significant percentage, and I believe there'd be a very high likelihood that we could increase our total number of providers in those settings if that were allowed.
Now, the difference between Washington and Oregon in terms of reimbursement rate is significant because I believe it's about $1,000 a month more in many cases. And secondly, don't they have an incentive program in Washington as well?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator said, I do understand that they do have some programs that will offer maybe an additional add-on payment or higher rate for folks who have a high Medicaid census. I think the percentage I've heard is 40 or 45% or higher Medicaid. And I think that is something when you look into rural communities around the state in particular and smaller communities, you generally speaking will find in smaller and more rural areas providers in general, and I don't care if you're a hospital, a nursing home, assisted living facility, you're generally going to have a much higher percentage of the individuals you're providing services to who rely on Medicaid to help cover the costs of their care. And I think that's just kind of an economic reality in some of those areas around our state. And so I think in particular in a lot of those areas and trying to maintain services and access in a lot of those communities, that that could be an effective strategy that could be pursued as well. And that's another one of those strategies that has been discussed here, and I think that's more of a 2009-2011 biennium and beyond discussion. And I think that the RFP that the state has already let and awarded on the market study and analysis could actually be very useful information as you would examine this particular issue about, you know, looking in high Medicaid census buildings.
Other questions? Thank you.
I'll have to get a catch-up later from what he said.
Yeah. Well, we talked about you while you were gone, but that's okay. You can watch the TV.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, if I might just add at least one more thing. I know that at least at one point we had a negative recommendation on part of this from an LFO budget analyst, and I think when it was down in Ways and Means on wanting to unschedule some of this funds, and that's not there in the co-chair's budget, you know, which we're appreciative of, but I did want to address that I believe that James Taves and the folks at SPD have been out working very hard. They've been looking at a lot of different strategies and a lot of different tools. They've been having a lot of conversations, and they're very far along the ways in planning on this. And if that recommendation were to be heeded and we were to try to delay this problem another 5 months or 6 months or 8 months or something like that, I think you're going to see a situation where they could lose additional existing provider capacity while we're sitting around talking about a lot of this stuff and not addressing the problem. And I think that they've done a very good job, as has this committee and Representative Cowan, in really addressing a lot of these issues, having some very detailed discussion on a lot of these issues and strategies. And I think that we need to take action now, and that this session's provided us an opportunity to take action now to address some of these issues in a timely fashion. So.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Bob Lawrence, would you come up, please? John Mullen. Jim Davis. Bob Lawrence.
Thank you, Senator Morissette. My name is Bob Lawrence. I'm the legislative coordinator for the Governor's Commission on Senior Services. Thanks for the opportunity to testify on behalf of Senate Bill 1061. We have been intimately involved in the process of developing this bill and are very encouraged by the work that has been done and that the future is well in your hands. During the legislative session 2007, we had spent a lot of time talking about planning for the next 10 years for the future on the Governor's Commission, and we feel that this bill is a good instrument to start the process. It's not the end-all and be-all, but it is the start, and we're very much encouraged and are willing to work as hard as we can to passage of this bill. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Kahn and I are both members of the Commission on Senior Services, the Governor's Commission, and I know that you went around the state 2 years ago. Are you still doing that?
We have some plans, Senator Morissette, to, in conjunction with SPD and other advocates, to return to the field to go over some of the things that have come up in the interim to speak to the public again and receive information about the plan for the future. We have two possible sites right now. One is Ontario, and the other one is Medford. Those are our two plans, but we'll have to coordinate that with the SPD.
Okay, good. Oh, well, I did attend a few of those when you went the last time, and I think the Governor's Commission on Senior Services is an extremely important forum. You meet often. I've been to not all of the meetings, but many of the meetings. And I think that we're trying to work with you. The legislature is trying to work with your advocacy group to develop a plan. So I really appreciate what you've been doing. Representative Cowan.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd just sort of like to follow up on that. I did attend some of those early conversations, and I think that the problem was laid out well in those conversations. The challenge at that point was some solution. So it is our hope that this bill will be a springboard to begin then to talk about the next steps, which are some short and long-term repairs to the system, and it's certainly meant to be inclusive enough to have that conversation. My specific question is the two locations that you mentioned, do you have any tentative dates set for those meetings?
I think May and September at this point, but we're just at the preliminary stages. We're trying to really track the expenses of such a venture, because there would be a lot of people that would have to fly to Boise, and at this point the local people are doing the organizational work to see if we can really get the community together, because when we visited Lake Oswego there was a lot of work that went in with the local politicians, the city council, and the local social service network. So we're wondering about it. We're also going to be talked to Debbie Bowers already, and she's going to be talking to James about the possibility that may be a joint meeting, but we're just at the preliminary stages. We did say the last time, because a lot of people have gone out and talked to people and there was no feedback. So we have sent out 400 letters to the people that had attended the last forums saying we promise that we would be back. And stay tuned. We will be there. We have made that promise. So those 400 letters went out last month, I believe, or the month before that. So we're very anxious. We enjoyed it. We enjoyed it a great deal. So.
Brief follow-up. I would be happy to assist with that. Our House Rural Policy Committee did a field trip to 5 Eastern Oregon counties to talk about some of the unique challenges that they faced. And Ontario is, you don't have to fly. It's only about an 8-hour drive. I do it all the time. It happens to be very close to where my daughter and by then new grandson or grandchild will be. So I'd be happy to help with that coordination. But there is a real sincere, I say that seriously, that there's a sincere interest in the part of folks, particularly in those very rural parts of our eastern side of our state, to talk about these issues that are unique to them. And I think it's imperative that we try to go to them once in a while and listen to those issues.
Senator Morissette and Representative Cowan, I have to remind you that 8-hour drive for some of the commission members is very difficult. We are getting older.
I like to split it in half when I can, too.
It's actually cheaper to fly than
yes,
to drive.
Yes, it is. So. It is.
Jim Davis.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Jim Davis, representing United Seniors of Oregon, Oregon State Council for Retired Citizens, Save Oregon Seniors, Advocacy Coalition of Seniors and People with Disabilities, and the Alliance for Retired Americans. We strongly support SB 1061 and have been very actively involved in what has been a very comprehensive process that was put together by Senator Morissette and Representative Cowan. And it's involved advocates and providers in the formation of what I think most of us would feel is a very strong piece of legislation, pretty much covering the major issues that we were concerned on in those meetings. SB 1061 has multiple purposes. It's practical in one sense and yet visionary and strategic in another, covering many of the current social policy issues that we feel were not adequately dealt with in the last session, in the 2007 session. On the practical side, our groups really feel that this session should deal with three issues that are addressed in 1061. And not all of our concerns necessarily are addressed in this issue. Sometimes they're addressed outside in the appropriations process or in other situations. But as the assisted living facilities are beginning to dump Medicaid at a very alarming rate, we feel there needs to be some kind of short-term solution to this problem and to begin to take care of what is very, very low reimbursement rates that have been in effect. We ultimately feel the 2009 session is going to really have to deal with this problem on a much more comprehensive level. But it's not a big surprise to us when you consider that during the 2001, the 2003, and the 2005 session, we were fighting for our lives just to save assisted living as a Medicaid option. And so once we got through those battles, essentially the reimbursement rates remained the same and didn't ever increase in the way that it should have during that time period. So we feel that is a definite concern. Oregon Project Independence is a program we love dearly, and it's a safety net for those who fall through the cracks of Medicaid, and it is terribly, sorely underfunded. We feel that a commitment needs to be made to the people with disabilities within Oregon Project Independence. The 2005 legislation brought them into OPI, but they have yet to be really incorporated into it because of the lack of funding. Sadly, OPI was taken out of the general fund last session, and we fought so hard to make that not happen, because the fact is that the Senior and Disability Tax Deferral Fund cannot sustain OPI. And it was always meant, and I know because I spent a lot of time on this legislation, that legislation in 2005 was always meant to be a supplement to OPI. OPI was supposed to be a strong part of the general fund, and that fund was supposed to be a supplement. And never was it ever meant to be the primary source of funding. And
well, as the one who carried the bill, I agree. And I've made that argument over and over and over, that it was not meant to be, you know, in place of the general fund. We've we will continue to make that argument.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. That's absolutely true. So we would like to see this session make some attempt, and I think in the rebalance it's being considered, but some attempt to expand OPI funding and put it back in the general fund and secure a spot in there, if only for symbolic reasons, so that in 2009 we can really get a chunk of funding into the general fund for
now,
this bigger program.
What we're trying to keep in place during the current time, I attended the Ways and Means Committee, and Legislative Fiscal recommended that they withdraw the $400,000, the remaining general fund money from the program, withdraw it.
Oh.
And that money currently goes to the providers who are hired to do the job for OPI. And I guess the rationale is, as long as we're no longer doing general fund for OPI, we may as well withdraw the remaining amount and then let them take that out of the tax deferral program. So my request to the Ways and Means at that last meeting 2 weeks ago was to please, please, please do not do it now. Let's wait until 09 when we can have an opportunity to address the adequate funding, but that's adding insult to injury to withdraw that $400,000 and put it into who knows what. So that's the big issue we're dealing with at the present time, is to keep that money. And I think we can keep it for the remainder of this biennium, and then in 09 we can revisit that discussion.
Well, we totally support you on that, Mr. Chair. One last issue that we have great concern is the issue around senior and disability, mental health, and addictions. And we appreciate the fact that it was brought out in this piece of legislation. It has been completely ignored in our system. The mental health and addiction needs of these two populations are not being considered and are not being taken care of. And we continue to come to legislature after legislature and bring this to light, that these are the population that have the highest depression and anxiety rates, highest mental health rates and mental health problems, and there's virtually nothing being done to help them. And so, but this will be answered in, we hope, in the passage of Senate Bill 1075, which will create the task force on the mental health needs of the underserved, helping us join with the ethnic minority community as well. Senator Gordley is sponsoring this bill, and it's being heard tomorrow, and we think that that's the first step now towards ultimately taking some programmatic and systematic approaches to dealing with these ignored populations. Finally, the development of a comprehensive plan around senior and disability issues is a great idea to allow proper emphasis to be placed on these critical issues as the boomers start exploding into the system. We think the grassroots advocacy community needs to be very much involved, and we would recommend to SPD that they reconvene the task force on the future of long-term care, which is lying dormant for a number of months now, and begin to involve all the who's who of the senior and disability community and the wonderful initial outline that's been raised in this bill. So overall, we support this bill. It's a very, very fine piece of legislation that a lot of work has gone into, and we hope you pass it out.
Thank you. Okay. John Mullen.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, John Mullen with the Oregon Law Center. And I'm also here today on behalf of the Human Services Coalition of Oregon. First of all, with respect to the Oregon Law Center, just wanted to mention that we were very happy to be involved in the work group that worked on Senate Bill 1061, and really want to thank you, Mr. Chair, and also Representative Cowan, for the inclusive nature of that discussion. The Oregon Law Center has been, for example, very concerned about the loss of the General Assistance Program, so to have the General Assistance Program be one of the issues that will be considered as far as fiscal and programmatic impact in looking forward to the 2009 session is really something that we're very grateful for, to see it there as well. That program has served the poorest of the poor among us. The Human Services Coalition, I would just mention that has been in existence since 1985. I was one of the founders, and I'm a current co-chair of the Human Services Coalition. And basically what we do is we look at human services issues across populations and across divisions and programs and even departments. And we look at the effort that's being made on behalf of people who need services, vulnerable Oregonians. The Human Services Coalition yesterday endorsed Senate Bill 1061. We were very pleased to do so, and we looked at it, even though it's serving a portion of the populations that we're concerned about, seniors and people with disabilities, we feel that this bill is very far-reaching and worthy of our support. The bill itself really starts out by looking at the past, where we've been, and why Oregon has been a model in long-term care. Talks about the crisis in funding issues, which has been addressed here today as far as community-based care, and then looks off to the future and says, and asks ourselves and commits ourselves as Oregonians to look at demographic changes and also programs that should be considered as we move into 2009 and beyond. So, again, the Oregon Law Center and the Human Services Coalition, very happy to support this bill, and I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Okay, Bill Olson, Art Towers, and Nicole. She's not here. Armstrong.
She did on there?
Nicole Armstrong didn't sign up, but... this is a command performance. So, Nicole, would you start off by giving us your...
My name? for the record, my name is Nicole Armstrong, and I'm here on behalf of O4AD, the Oregon Association of Area Agencies on Aging and Disabilities. And I'm here to say that L4ID is very in support of this bill. Of course, we have been working very closely with our partners as well as with the members of this committee and with Representative Cowan to work through trying to find and identify real solutions to the quickly eroding infrastructure around the Aging and Disability Services Network. And I think that things like the increase in nursing home placements as well as the Medicaid rates issues in the home community-based care setting is really the red flag siren about what's going on out there. And when we're talking about the Medicaid rates issues, from our side and in the area agencies, our case managers are constantly faced now with the question of, I have a client here who is eligible for a Medicaid placement in a community-based care setting, and where do I put them? For example, in Klamath Falls, there are no other options. You have to leave that local community. Representative Cowan faced that in her local community. That's becoming the case more and more often around the state. The options are limited, even if you are eligible for that, even if you could be placed in a less restrictive care setting, the care settings aren't there anymore to be had. So the work of Section 1 in this bill is incredibly important to make sure that we are addressing that, not just in the short term, but also in the long term. And I'd be happy to answer any questions if you have any.
Any questions? Okay. Thank you. Bill Olson.
Chair Morrison, members of the committee, my name is Bill Olson. I'm a co-chair of the Advocacy Coalition of Seniors and People with Disabilities. I'm here to support Senate Bill 1061. I won't repeat my basic testimony, which I provided in January at your hearing, I believe on the 10th, if I recall the date correctly. But we have resubmitted a letter and some comments on the bill. I think the main point I wanted to make, because others have already given you eloquent testimony that we would support, is that the one item we saw missing in, I believe it's Section 3, where you itemize certain issues to be costed for the next session, we feel that family caregiving and volunteer caregiving needs to be addressed in terms of supports for those people. looking at the demographics challenge that we're facing that you've all heard about ad nauseum, the ratio of caregivers to people needing care is going to dictate that those volunteer and family caregivers bear an even greater burden. And they can't be replaced with paid caregivers just due to the fiscal constraints that we've all recognized. So we've got to address their needs and try to keep them healthy and in a manner that allows them to continue to provide the important care, which we all know they provide. Respite care, for example, needs to be expanded for families particularly. So we'd like to see that explicitly added to that list of items to be costed, basically an expansion or an enhancement of the existing family care and support programs that the state provides. Other than that, if you have questions, I'd be happy to try to respond to them.
Good. Thank you very much. Good suggestion. Art Towers.
For the record, my name is Arthur Towers, political director for Service Employees Union Local 503. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I really want to commend you, Chair Morissette, members of the committee, Representative Cowan, for fighting for the vulnerable. I mean, you're doing good work on this legislation. Obviously, this is a great bill. But really what you're doing is standing up for those in need. And the work you've done on that, on this legislation and throughout the previous sessions is really appreciated. So thank you. Again, we strongly support everything in the bill. You're totally on the right track. The care providers that we represent are fighting for quality care. And we appreciate the opportunity to join with you on that. I want to piggyback on Bill's comments around family care providers. Senator Cruz made some good comments earlier on today, but if Section 1 does stay in the bill, we would propose a one-sentence addition to that section, just clearly stating that the department may adjust rates for other adult foster home providers, because this bill, as it's written, covers a large group of providers, the adult foster care providers, those who are commercial providers for seniors and people with physical disabilities, but it doesn't cover a couple other types of providers, care providers for the developmentally disabled, for example, but a group of care providers for seniors as well. I want to dwell on that last group for a moment. And that is the group of adult foster care providers who provide care for relatives. Over the course of the past 3 years, that population has dwindled by 23%, and rates have stayed flat for the last 5 years. And so it's become very, very difficult for family members who have it in their heart to care for a relative, to make ends meet, to do this, and it's pushed people into other types of care settings. And so we don't want to mess around and rob Peter to pay Paul here by taking money from Ways and Means is looking like it's setting aside for the professional commercial providers. We're gung-ho to fly into the headwind and find more general fund money for this group, but we just want to spell out that the department may adjust rates for other adult foster care providers. The rate differential between commercial providers and relative providers is pretty dramatic, about 25%. Relatives get paid less. And again, we aren't here advocating for dollar for dollar increases one group for another. All we're saying is if the department can have some latitude clearly spelled out to adjust those rates, that would be great. I'll stop there, but again, we strongly support the bill and just appreciate your efforts a great deal up and down the line. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay, if we leave, well, I understand what you're saying about Section 1. What about other sections of the bill that might address your issue as well? There's Section 2, which asks the department, will develop a comprehensive plan to care for a system for seniors and people with disabilities, and then it lists various aspects of that. Are you included in that area?
Yes. Chair Morissette, I feel that we're pretty well covered in many of these other in many of these other sections. I think that we're just fine. Know that one set of adult foster care providers, I believe, aren't care for clients that are not covered by Medicaid, and that's adult foster care providers who care for the mentally ill, and that's another. I feel like that's another conversation since this is Medicaid focused.
Okay, except in section 2 on line 30, develop a model for long-term care system that is not funded by Medicaid, which is interesting. I guess that would be...
Chair Morissette, that could be construed that way. I've been thinking about that during the drafting process, that what we're talking about in that section are seniors and people with physical disabilities who are marginally too wealthy to qualify for Medicaid, as opposed to other non-Medicaid populations. But you're absolutely right. That could be construed to include the mentally ill who are in long-term care.
Okay. Where did that language come from?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
If we could try to answer that question, I think that much of the language that you're describing on page 2, line 30, and on...
Well, is, just that line 31.
31 specifically.
Well, yeah.
Was designed around the concept, and I think it's important to understand that none of this language is intended to be exclusive, but rather to set the stage for a conversation that we want to have. And it was designed around the desire to address pre-Medicaid. What more could we reasonably do within the system to help people who are not currently on Medicaid forestall that day by providing better community-based services that they wouldn't need to spend down and that they could continue in a more cost-effective or cost-avoiding kind of system. And there were a lot of ideas thrown out, but they're still in the conceptual and developmental stage, and so the language is intended to be non-exclusive so that we can develop that concept. Now, there may be a better way to say it, but I think that
I think
was
that's
the
a
intent.
Good way to say it. Then on line 33, and we're getting into another concept that we're not going to necessarily talk about today, but it deals with the single point of entry for the entire aging services network. And that would include Project Independence, but it also could include a community effort, as is done in Lane County for 100% access, where various organizations come together and provide volunteer services, grant money, community money for services. A single point of entry would expand what we're, I think, trying to do, and it would include non-Medicaid funding. But the first thing that comes to mind with Project Independence is a non-Medicaid program that keeps people, you know, from entering into that program. But there's more to it than that. There, you know. Okay, I just want to say that if the dire predictions are true that we're on the verge of a major, well, even a minor recession, we're talking about a 2-year recovery time. We're talking tough times ahead. And whether or not we can count on federal money, because the federal budget is going to make major cuts in the programs that are near and dear to our hearts. If we're talking about lack of state money to support these programs, then where are we going to go? Now, the local funding is also in deep, deep trouble. I know Lane County is making major, major cuts. So I guess one of the things we're trying to do is provide the best possible service at the lowest cost to the taxpayers. and to get our act together so in 2 years we can come back, or next year, and say, okay, this is the plan that we have developed over this intervening time period, and we've done a pretty good job, and now we do need some support services. For instance, how do we maintain the volunteer part of the program? We need to have some funding for coordinators, because you can't have volunteers without coordination, and that includes the Ombudsman program, as well as RSVP, as well as a respite program, and so on. So that's kind of what we're looking at, is a comprehensive program that deals with the need of the aging. This is kind of an alternative to the bill that we had, which did have a big fiscal that would have addressed the baby boomer tsunami preparedness. Well, that would have cost a lot of money. We're doing the same thing, only on a larger scale, and we're doing it through the efforts of the local community and volunteers and so on. So I think we're on the right track.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Just to follow up on that point and some of the others that, and my apologies for having to run in and out, but some of the others that, points that are made, that whole spectrum of volunteer-based or something that we can provide within our communities, my thought process as we talked about developing this is that we don't want to be narrow in our thinking as to what programs we have out there. Should we specifically bolster this one, you know, RSVP, Senior Companions, whatever else we might be talking about, or should we allow ourselves to be more forward-thinking? We have a burgeoning population of people retiring who are also not yet in need of some sort of services, but bring with them a wealth of life experiences and interests and abilities and commitments that I think it's really important that we leave it open enough that we think outside the box a little bit about what people might choose to develop in their community-based offerings. You know, there's a bunch of us sitting here that might be down the road be tapped into as some creative volunteers when we quit having so much fun over here in Salem. And I think that there are many other people like that in the world. And I'm trying to keep this forward-thinking and let us have room to come up with new ideas rather than lock into the specificities of one program.
Absolutely. Okay.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, and I agree with that. I think the important thing, and clearly the advocates can branch out further. The specific purpose of Section 3 is what we want the department to report on, and I think the specificity there is appropriate, but it doesn't preclude other activities. Mm-hmm. So.
That being said, I do have one question that I don't know who we should pose it to before we
move this. Writer of the bill, we could ask her to.
No, it's not that. It's the general category of the younger adult with physical disabilities that. I think it was the intention in the work group that we had to kind of include some focus on the fact that not all the services that that particular group of people need may be the same as an aging population. And at one point we talked about just sort of a recognition of that. There have been efforts to develop a task force around it. I don't think at this point we should get that specific, but in the initial phases of developing this bill, we sort of left out the category of traumatic brain injury individuals, not intentionally. And I'm wondering if the physically challenged adults in the younger age group is another piece that we may want to highlight somewhere in our laundry list in Section 3. And so it might be helpful if we could bring back Mr. Taves or somehow see if the department has a plan for addressing that particular piece of it, or if there's additional language that we might want to consider before we finalize this.
Well, I guess I would ask our legislative counsel if that concept is embodied in this, specifically or by implication. Would you like to come up? And James, would you please come back up? Okay, I guess one of the problems that we have is the parameters of what we're trying to do. Now, we're dealing with a long-term care for seniors. Now, certainly there are the disabled who are not seniors, but there are also seniors who suffer from traumatic brain injury and so on. And so there's some vague overlapping lines here. First of all, Lori, what's your take on that?
Chair Courtney, members of the committee, Lori Freeman, Office of Legislative Counsel. In Section 3, there actually, Subsection 9 has a reference to individuals with traumatic brain injury.
Mm-hmm. We reinserted that because it sort of got forgotten. And right. So I'm wondering about the second part of the population.
All of this sort of evolved out of your interim committee meetings. I think it's certainly broad enough that it would encompass the younger.
I'm sorry.
I don't know what the joke is either.
Younger individuals with disabilities as well as the seniors. It seems fairly comprehensive to me.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair?
Yes.
It has always intended to be comprehensive, and I appreciate that review. And so it may be simply enough that we've sort of raised the issue and that we all on the record and that we all remember that that's part of the mm-hmm. comprehensive conversation that needs to take place down the road.
Yeah, I just want to congratulate Ms. Freeman and for all the hard work she's done, because we've worked very hard on this and she has worked very hard on it. And I know that individual words have implications and meaning, like sufficient cost and so on and so forth. And so that's why I asked her to be here today, because there are some things that we may have questions about that we want to tweak or expand upon. And I appreciate your explanation of that. So if we need to go further than that, we can. But we have to, my feeling is we have to be kind of careful not to just, you know, we can't solve all the problems of the world. We're dealing with the long-term care issue. Mm-hmm. is what we're basically right. dealing with. Now, people with the disabilities certainly should be included in Project Independence. That, you know, that the statute says that, but we don't fund it. But, you know, they're not forgotten. James, would you have any comments?
Mr. Chairman, yes, just a real quick comment. Again, the bill calls for comprehensive planning for seniors and people with disabilities. So, I mean, there is no intent, certainly on our part, to exclude or diminish the role of people with disabilities. And actually, there are some emerging issues for younger disabled folks that are that need to be singled out. It's increasingly difficult for people with physical disabilities to remain at home with their in-home services because of the pay-in or the offset requirements. If you're between 100 and 300% of SSI as financial eligibility under federal and state rules, over 100%, you have to pay everything towards the cost of your care, which leaves very little or almost nothing to maintain your household. And that's an issue we're working on right now. We're talking, and we'll be talking at length with people with physical disabilities, and that's kind of a unique issue for younger disabled folks. So, I think our plan will highlight, and even if we need to do some changes and to set up some separate categories in the home and community-based waiver, because right now our whole Medicaid program is across the board for seniors and people with disabilities, the same service types and options. But again, some of the financial eligibility issues, particularly around employment, and we've worked pretty hard on that in the past, so people can be employed, still buy into the Medicaid program for their medical assistance and for the price of paying for their personal aids, which otherwise would be too costly and would prevent them from being employed. So it's a very important issue, and it's certainly our intent to put that group front and center in terms of some unique recommendations within the plan.
Okay. One other thing while you're here, the rebalance is comes about because of a change in the MMIS, which I guess is Medicare Medicaid Information Services. Is it a tracking system that has been put in place that what's the cause of the rebalance? I understand it has a caseload implication and so on, but what does the tracking system have to do with that?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not the person to answer that. We need someone from the technical side, from Oregon Information Services. Or MMIS, is the federal government is requiring all of us to, over time, move all of our payment systems into a fee-for-service single Medicaid payment system. And we have very different payment systems that we're all trying to evolve into that overall MMIS system. I can't speak to the issues in the rebalance on that specifically.
Okay, but and I guess the other reason I raise that issue is because Representative Gelser asked if there was rebalance money available for a different category of disability services, maybe adult foster home disability services and so on. And you indicated no, that was not part of, there was not rebalanced money available for that.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. What we put in our rebalance plan, as I've tried to indicate before, didn't deal with a lot of the rate issues or inequities across different systems. Mm-hmm. We were dealing only with the Medicaid crisis in lost capacity in the senior and physical disability part of our system. So that is correct. We did not include in the rebalance increases for foster care, for developmental disabilities, relative foster care, and some of the other categories. That's correct.
Okay.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
Could we pursue this just a little further and with the perfect two people at the table here. I'm interested in some input on the, first of all, the department's proposal for replacement language that would address the problems with the term sufficient in Section 1, Subsection 2, and we had submitted here some proposed language adjustments. And then we also heard testimony from Arthur Towers about adding to that an additional sentence around departmental authority, or that they may adjust other rates as funds are available, or something to that effect. So it's sort of a twofold question. I'm interested from our drafter's perspective if this would be acceptable replacement language from in Section 1, and secondly, from the departmental standpoint, if that the may adjust is acceptable, because I understand that the reasoning behind that suggestion is to deal with the question you just brought up, that if there are additional funds available, the department has the authority to look at other rate adjustments for the populations you were just describing. So I don't know that that's a specific question, but I'm really interested in whether we should be working some language before we
were you,
talk about this again.
I don't know if you were in the room when we addressed this issue at the beginning of the
And I'm probably hearing. Just going to be, you know, sort of slapped around for not being here at the right time.
Well, you'd be slapped around for not being here.
Okay.
The word sufficient is unacceptable language.
I guess my question is, did you specifically decide to move ahead with this suggested amendment, or are we still debating that?
No, we're not going to submit the amendment right now. We're going to try to move the bill. We need to discuss this.
That's why I wanted.
Okay,
if we
now
could
let
get
me
a little
refer
testimony on that amendment.
To James. The word may. What impact, if any, will that have, that the department may, Mr. Towers' amendment? That's
Mr.
permissive
Chairman,
language.
Mr. Chairman, we're fine with adding other categories under the guise of may. just to back up again, I mean, technically we don't need Section 1 for any rate adjustment. Mm-hmm. We do that in the budget process. We do it through emergency board actions all the time, in as much as it's part of the bill to be highlighted in the overall issues before you, adding those other groups under the guise of May, assuming the dollars are found within the department's budget or in the Ways and Means process, we're fine with that.
Okay. Other, did you have a response of any kind to that?
Chair Courtney, Senator Morissette, I...
No.
You're the chair. Okay. All right.
He's the president. He's the chair.
I see. They were playing.
They were playing with the chair.
I didn't even notice that.
Sorry. Chair Morissette. The way this is structured, I just wanted to sort of go back and say we have Section 1. Well, everyone knows what Section 1 is intended to do. 2 is sort of the comprehensive planning, and 3 is asking the department to come up with cost projections for various very detailed things. And, you know, there might be possible to incorporate 3 into 2. So you have... perhaps not coming back to the next legislative assembly, but as part of the comprehensive planning process, come to interim committees with cost projections on various things so that, depending on what the projections are, they could be incorporated into the ultimate plan. That might be another way to structure it.
Hmm. Interesting.
Yeah. But specifically in Section 1, and I appreciate Senator Cruz's comments earlier that if we can do this in a different way and take this one out, that's certainly something we need to pursue. But if it's left in the bill, I wondered if you had an opportunity to look at the language that the department submitted in testimony today and if you saw any specific concerns with replacement language to try to get a little more away from some of the words that are challenging and leave it more open to opportunity.
Chair Morissette, Representative Cowan, I have seen the language. Mr. Taves just shared it with me, but I had seen it before. The problem with the language is it requires the department to make an adjustment, but it doesn't say what kind of adjustment, how much of an adjustment, are you adjusting up, are you adjusting down, by how much. And so in drafting this language, we were trying to get to the point of the adjustment, which is these facilities are turning people away because the Medicaid rates are too low. And when you couple that with the moratorium so that you have no competition in the market, then, and you can fill all these facilities with private pay patients, and there's no incentive to take the Medicaid. So basically what we're trying to do is say, all right, well, what is it that you want the rates to do? When you make the adjustment, what do you want them to do? Well, you want them to be set at a level sufficient to what they said was forestall further loss of Medicaid contracted capacity, which I believe is the same as maintaining the capacity of the residential care facilities and adult foster homes. So the sufficiency just gets to, you need to figure out what that rate is, and that's where you need to set it. Nowhere in this language does it say anything about guaranteeing rates or guaranteeing capacity. So to the extent that there would be any gamesmanship about facilities raising their rates, saying, well, you have to guarantee it, you're going to have that as a result of the combination of the moratorium and the rates as they are now. I don't think it comes from, I mean, I think that already exists, is that facilities sort of have the department over the barrel because it's more profitable to have the private pay folks than the Medicaid rates.
Mm-hmm. Okay. When we come back on Wednesday, we will I guess, have to make a decision if we're going to move the bill on Friday about amendments that we want to make to the bill, if we want to move the bill on Friday. So that's something that we can work on. Yes.
Chair Morissette, I just wanted to make one more comment, and that is that I do think the best way to go about this would be not have Section 1 in there and use the Ways and Means process. But again, the way this was structured, as you'll notice in Section 6, it's repealed. And after the next legislative session.
Which is an interesting...
So the idea is that it is supposed to be a temporary fix, and then...
Which is what the rebalance is.
Right.
Well, and then the as we discussed earlier, the benefit would be that we would actually have a bill that could pass both houses and signed by the governor that would do something that we want to have done. Otherwise, the whole thing might end up in Ways and Means and not go anywhere. So that's something we have to consider.
Sure.
Senator Cruz.
Yeah, and kind of on one of the things Lori said about the combination of 2 and 3, I'm not sure about the combination, but looking at the time of reporting is an issue, I think, knowing that the department will be, if they're going to be including these things, will have costed them and made recommendations for their for budgets well in advance of that. And I guess I just looked at if they're going to report to the next regular session, that really kind of hamstrings us for our planning as well. That maybe...
Which line are you on here?
Page 2,
24, 25. Section 3, 24, 25.
I'm wondering if we should be considering a time frame a little bit before the convening of the session, back to the interim committees, for our ability to, and it's crunching you a little bit, but a lot of this stuff you're going to be compressed on anyway, so... That's something that we might want to consider for our planning if we're going to come forward with bills on RSVP and these other programs. It would be nice to have some lead time before January of 2009 to find out where the department is and see how that fits in with our plan. So just a thought.
I think that's an excellent suggestion. And actually, when you've already started, have you started the budget process?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Cruz, we agree, and I think on the House side a couple of weeks ago, I think we were asked the same question, and I said we recognize that and would try to plan a timetable that would allow for interim committees to review our work well in advance of the next session. But yes, we're starting the budget planning process right now. We're working on the continuing service level or the base budget. I'm not sure what we call it anymore, and then we'll start moving on to the policy packages, and that will happen between now and July. So. And in that same time frame, we're putting together a long-range plan, and we'll be costing out other scenarios that may or may not be included in the budget. So, but I think we could commit to a timetable where we'd return to interim committees with at least status reports or preliminary projections. Again, we want time to meet with stakeholders so they're not... necessarily objecting here to things that they haven't even seen before. It's been vetted with them, so that needs to factor into our timetable as well.
James, I guess I'm kind of looking, if we had a August September sort of time frame, it after you've made your recommendations budget wise, and then it would still give us time to build our agenda as well. That's kind of what I'm looking at, is to give us time. Obviously stakeholders have to be involved, but next January is not a good time frame for building an agenda for next January. So it just truly isn't. So
I think we're all aiming at the same thing, and right now I'm kind of focused on whether there's specific language changes that need to be made. But I think the concept was that the comprehensive plan comes back in, what you said, by June of 2008, I believe, or June, July. And then with that, the interim work and the stakeholder work will be to develop ways to address as many of the things on this list that, that are reasonable to be addressed in 09. I think the kind of thought process behind the report to the regular legislative session is more to validate the reasonings for whatever bills may be in front of us in 09, that these are the dollars numbers of what the cost benefit is to what we have, and perhaps some other things that will not be on the list for 09, but that we'll be able to say down the road the cost of this will be as we address, because we can't do it all in one session. So I guess with that kind of general thought process in mind, I'm looking to see if we need to do specific changes in the language.
Well, we're talking line 2425 again, and I don't know if there needs to be any change in that. The caveat or the expectation is that there would be a reporting made as...
Mr. Chairman, would it be helpful by Friday? We'll come back with
a time table, if we can
put together that sort of steps out initial proposal, stakeholder involvement, interim committee review.
Wonderful.
And
with that in hand, any suggestions you have for specific language adjustments? Because we really would like to try to move it on to the next step.
Yeah. Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative, I mean, we'll certainly be willing to go on the record and.
Okay, so we'll work. Okay, good. Okay, other questions, comments? Okay, seeing none, thank you very much. Anyone else in the audience wishing to testify?
Well, yes.
I'm sorry.
We do have one more.
Oh, my apologies. You didn't sign up.
I wasn't sure.
And I was going to call you anyway, but you were standing by the door, so I thought you wanted to get out of here.
I always want to do that.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Rick Bennett, Director of Government Relations for AARP Oregon. I was not interested in just coming up and saying me too. We do, in fact, support Senate Bill 1061, and we think it's a good bill. I wanted to make just a couple of comments related to some of the things that have been said. Related to the reimbursement rates, clearly Section 1 is a Band-Aid. It's there to address a very immediate, urgent situation. And we do recognize that when you change some rates, there may be implications for other rates as well. And so as Mr. Towers indicated, we also support at least some type of permissive language that allows us to perhaps during this month see if there might be other funds available that could be held in case there are issues with some of the other rates not addressed specifically here. It is not our interest, AARP's interest, to in any way water down the soup or thin it in any way related to the department's rebalance proposal as far as the $9.75 million related to the assisted living and adult foster care homes. But we would like at least the opportunity that if we can convince people that maybe some additional dollars are needed, that the department has that permissive language that would allow them to utilize those dollars. Related to Senator Cruz's question on the timing for Section 3, I would also hope that information in Section 3 is available much sooner, not only for you, but for the advocates as well. In my conversations with Mr. Taves, he's indicated that is indeed something that should be very doable, and so I would just agree that we'd like to see that information sooner rather than later. The one last thing I would say is... all of you will be, hopefully by the end of the day, receiving this piece of information. And what it does is, first of all, indicates a number of advocates and organizations who have come together in what we're calling a campaign for Oregon seniors and people with disabilities. It identifies Senate Bill 1061 as a key action item for us this session. It identifies several other items as well. that are very limited in their nature, but we think are important for seniors and people with disabilities, and we think they're, like I say, very limited in their scope and should be addressed during this session as well. And so I hope you'll take a minute or two to take a look at the pamphlet, and if you have any questions, there's a number of us that'll be very pleased to answer them for you. That, thank you very much.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Okay, because we did have SCR 24 on the agenda, anyone here to testify on that? It will be on the agenda on for Thursday, and we will lead off with that. That's the Hood to the Coast.
I could run around the building until then.
Yeah, okay. So, with that, we will close the public hearing, and we are adjourned.